Our guest this hour does have many talents, so many, in fact, that the poster advertising his Ashland appearance tonight almost had to go to a second line of titles. Kwame Dawes is our guest, appearing tonight at 7:30 at Ashland High School, welcomed by Chautauqua poets and writers. Kwame is a Chancellor Professor of English at the University of Nebraska. He teaches post-colonial literature and theory, African-American literature, and Caribbean literature, and he's a member of the Creative Writing Program at UNL. He's also the editor-in-chief of Prairie Schooner, the 85-year-old quarterly featuring the best poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and reviews from the United States and abroad. We can call him poet, playwright, novelist, actor, singer, musician, and a winner of many awards, including an Emmy for the website Live Hope Love, Living and Loving with AIDS in Jamaica. So, wow, a lot of accomplishments, Kwame Dawes. Thanks so much for joining us in The Exchange.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Now, you were 10 when you moved from Ghana to Jamaica, is that right?
That's about right, yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a brief hiatus in London for about a year. So I think we left Ghana when I was about 9. Mm-hmm. Spent a year in England and then moved to Jamaica when I was about 10. Yeah.
So just within your own body and soul, a lot of cultural influences from different places.
Yeah, and in my blood. It's peculiar. My father was Jamaican, although he had the added complication of having been born in Nigeria to Jamaican parents who were sort of missionary teachers in Nigeria. So he grew up in Jamaica, and then my mother is Ghanaian, and so I have all of that wonderful Pan-African blood running through me. Yeah.
Well, I noticed a few online references to your work as African poetry, and I use the quote fingers for African poetry. Is that a fair assessment? Does the term even particularly make sense to you?
It makes sense. I think it's becoming so more recently because of the work that I've been doing with the African Poetry Book Fund, which is a very specific project to publish African poets and to give attention to poets out of Africa, where until we started this project, there was just not one single press that was devoted exclusively to publishing African poets. So we've been doing some great work in that regard. And I think the association, I was born in Ghana, I am Ghanaian, but until then, I was probably better known as a kind of Jamaican reggae kind of guy. But with this new attention to the African thing, that side of me appears. And it's fine with me. I could be called Martian for all I care, as long as it gets the job done.
With all you do, is there one central theme, one central motivator to your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one sort of core thing, which is I'm interested in stories and in the idea of telling stories and in the art of telling stories. I've been trained in literature. I've been trained in the book. I've been trained to see the value of poetry and language. So those things are a big part of what I do. But I suppose the core impulse is the idea of story and the ways in which story, as told by ourselves, give us, even if it's a fleeting, delusionary sense of control, at least it's something. But it also is a way of leaving memory, leaving a history, leaving a legacy of tradition and identity for people who will come after us, immediately for family and then broader for the rest of the people who sort of associate with us. And then more broadly, there's that old hubris of the artist, which says, if I do great work, I will live on for 100 years, which happens to only a few, but we can be forgiven for trying.
Right. That fleeting delusionary sense of control you mentioned, that's a key
right.
phrase.
Very important.
In the sense that we control our own stories for just that moment?
We do, and we think, well, I can sort of use a simple, sort of funny example, which means it won't be funny, having introduced it as
such. Once you say that, yeah.
Once I say that, it's going to be unfunny. But, you know, I remember one of the first things that drove me to writing and made me interested in writing was not poems or novels or anything like that, but letters. In the 70s, I was an avid pen pal, so I had pen pals all over the world, and I'd write these letters to them. And this is pre, you know, Facebook, Google, or any of that kind of stuff. So the only information that anybody outside of Jamaica would have about Jamaica would be in some really dated encyclopedias and books that were not current. So anything I said about my life in Jamaica, well, I controlled this person's knowledge of me. And I found it really invigorating to know that you know, if I said, you know, I just had ackee and saltfish, and they'll go, what is that? And I would have to describe it, the texture, everything about it. And I love that. I love the sense when they would write back and say it was as if I was there. But the other part of it, which is a little more dubious, is the sense that I could lie and get away with it. You know what I mean? So I thought, you know, and I love that. And if I was describing how I got beat up at school, I would be the hero in the narrative. Even if I was honest about it, I could talk about how ugly the guy was and how his breath smelled. And in the telling of my defeat, I became the champion of that defeat. That sense of controlling the narrative, and like I said, it's illusory because we don't control anything, but in that moment you do have a sense that your life is ordered, you control it, and you can make it happen as you want it to.
You're not the master of your fate, but you're master of the telling of this version
exactly.
of your fate. Kwame Dawes, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, brought to Ashland by Chautauqua Poets and Writers, appearing at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Kwame and listen to some of the materials that he's put out there in the world. Some of the stuff on the website, Live, Hope, Love, or just there. Well, words can't describe it, so we'll let it do its own work. When we come back from this break with Kwame Dawes, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Music of Bob Marley brings us back into this segment of the Jefferson Exchange because we're talking to Kwame Dawes, the poet. He is Ghanaian by birth. He is Jamaican by upraising. He's now in the state of Nebraska teaching. And he also wrote a book a few years ago, among all the other things he does, which was a book about the lyrical genius of Bob Marley. And so we'll sprinkle a little more Bob Marley throughout the hour here. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Kwame Dawes, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. You have so many outlets for expression. I mean, there's so many different things you do. I've heard you talk about poetry as if it is a better way to convey an idea. And I assume by that you mean better than prose or song or anything. But so what makes it better? What is it about poetry that makes it so good an outlet?
It's a good outlet, not in the sense that a poem becomes the best way to convey an idea, but the process of poetry, the poetics of poetry, in other words, offer us a kind of discipline about how to use language that can affect all areas of communication and writing, and that do affect these different areas. Poetry introduces a discipline that is contained in the idea that we are using language to express something in ways that are fresh, that are direct, and that do the labor of trying to be as accurate and engaging as possible. And therefore, built into it is the idea of communicating, but also idea of communicating well and also beautifully. And when you put those things together, then it makes sense when we see a great soccer player making a move and we say, that's a poetic move. Or when we see something, a musician doing something remarkable, we say that's poetic. I think in that sense, poetry gives us a kind of discipline, a sensibility that says there's a wonderful combination of beauty and an order and discipline and a desire to communicate wonderfully. And I think that's what I cherish about the idea of poetry.
When did you start writing poetry? Did playwriting come first? Was it then poetry? Is it in that order?
It's a peculiar thing. I mean, you know, the old stories, and you can imagine I've answered this question so many times, but the old story is that when I was 12 years old, I was in school, I wrote a poem, it was about a mango, it was wonderful, my teacher loved it, they showed it to my parents, I stopped writing poetry forever. And so that's one story. So that's it. So I could say, well, I did write poetry first, but I don't think so. I think I played around with poetry, but I don't think I was doing it well. But I was really discouraged from writing poetry by a teacher who just said my work was horrendous and told me to destroy it. And I was so devastated, I said, I'm not writing again. And a bunch of friends tricked me into writing a play. So I wrote a play, and the play was staged and so on. So I thought, okay, I'll be a playwright. So I became a playwright. And for the next 10 years, I was writing for the stage, but writing poetry quietly on my own. So there's a way in which I've always been interested in all forms of writing, poetry, stories, and so on. But when somebody asked me, what was I? In my 20s, I was a playwright. I wrote poems, but I was a playwright. I think it took my third book of poems before I kind of said, okay, yeah, I guess I'm a poet. It's kind of stupid not to. You've got three books of poems right. And people have given you awards. You might want to claim it. Because I hold poetry in fairly high regard, and I know there are a lot of poets who don't write poetry because they behave like poets, mm-hmm. and I find that annoying.
That sounds like a public sort of representation.
Yeah. They look very serious and dreamy.
Any names you want to mention along the way?
I'm leaving it alone.
I thought you'd go. So I'm curious that your friends tricked you into writing plays?
I'm not making this up. So they came to me. I was a student at university, and they came to my room and said, we're trying something. We're going to get a bunch of guys to write some plays, and then we'll see which one works, and we'll do it. And I said, well, why are you asking me? They said, well, you know, you write and do that kind of thing. So I said, okay. And they said, yeah, so this was like a Thursday, and they said, we'll come back Monday for the play. And I thought, seriously? And they said, yeah. So I said, all right. And I said, you're asking everybody else? And they said, yeah. So I went about over the weekend, and I wrote this play. They came in, they read it in front of me and said, okay, thanks, we're going to do this. And I said, well, what about everybody else? They said, we didn't ask anybody else. Nobody would be crazy enough to write a play over the weekend. We're doing this. This is all we got. And the play went on to do really well, so... That was it.
Kwame Dawes, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, poet, novelist, singer, Emmy Award winner. Well, let's talk about the Emmy Award stuff because your HIV/AIDS work. You were back in Jamaica 8 years ago. Drawn there to what? Did you what?
Well, the truth is, my family is in Jamaica. All my siblings in Jamaica. I think I'm back in Jamaica 4 or 5 times a year. But the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting approached me and asked me if I would do some reporting on HIV in Jamaica. Initially, I said no. I said I'm not a journalist per se. I'd worked as a journalist, but I'd done with that. And they said they want a writer to do it. So I agreed to do it. And this simply meant going to do interviews with people who were living with AIDS and so on. And I think they wanted me to do it because, of course, I have good connections in Jamaica. And it was a hard field because there's a lot of stigma attached and people would not talk. And they especially wouldn't talk to somebody who was not from the island. And that opened all kinds of doors, and we got this done. And while I was doing the interviews and writing these articles, I was writing poems at night just to sort of essentially to cope with the experience. I wasn't writing poems for any other purpose but the same purpose I always write poems, which is to engage the moment poetically. And when we came together to put the whole project together, we talked about using the poems as part of the framework, and soon the poems became the center of the project. And it was interesting because there was some anxiety at first whether this was going to be journalistic, effectively a journalistic piece. But I think people became convinced, and once we put it together, the impact would have been tremendous. So it was exciting when we won the Emmy because it was the first time this was a poetry-centered piece. But it was compelling in that sense because it had that dimension.
Well, I'm struck by the flexibility of the people on the project, though. I mean, we're talking the Pulitzer Center. Yeah. So it started as straight journalism.
Absolutely. I think what people discovered, I think I have to credit the work itself for doing what it did. The weird thing about poetry is, in journalism, you somebody has to say something before you can actually write it. If you're talking to somebody and say, tell me about your husband, she says, I hated him, and so on, you can write that down. But she might say, I love him. And you look in her eyes and you know she's saying, I hated the guy. Even though she says that, you cannot write that. You can't say, well, it looked like she was saying as a journalist. But as a poet, God knows I can say anything I want. I can do that. And so, I'm being funny, but the truth is, the poetry went below the surface and engaged other kind of impulses that we recognize to be part of the news impulse, the impulse of engagement with humans. And I think when we were able to bring those two things together, the discipline of strict journalism with the opportunities that poetry on earth that a journalist will not normally be able to eke out, people recognize that this whole thing was a really powerful story. And and a story well told. So it was very exciting. And we were able to repeat that model. So it wasn't a fluke when we went to Haiti and back to Jamaica and so on. So
the poem Nickel in particular caught me. I listened to you read it twice, including from the piece on NewsHour, a bunch of years ago.
Yeah.
Some of the lines in there, all those women slain by your art.
Yeah.
Is one that really that rides in there.
Yeah, Nickel was a tall, beautiful man. When I met him, he had been ravaged by strokes in his body. A young fella, but he was a beautiful guy, and you could tell he was a charmer, and he was full of talk, but he could barely speak. And I was just moved by this body, this broken body, and what he used to be with the women. The women loved him. And HIV had just broken him down into this guy who could only utter, "Man must live. You know, man must just live." Mm-hmm. The last line of survival. Yeah.
We have the musical version of this ready. Megan, I'm going to ask you to play the one that is called Dawes Nickel. So let's hear this musical version right off the website.
Every smile is defiance. Slap your knees, tell your story. Stretch your legs and remember all those women slain by your art. All those women slain by your art. The way you pulled your body upright, the crawl you made towards sunlight. Stretch your legs and remember, tell your story. Man must live, tell your story. Man must live. Every smile is defiance. The virus prances through your blood. Stretch your legs and remember, tell your story. Man must live, tell your story. Man must live.
How coolly it's broken you, trying to mask the knowing wit behind your eyes. Every smile, brilliant against your gleaming black face, is defiance. You stammer, push out words, tell your story, slap your knees to show where your stroke-frozen body would crawl across the concrete to reach the yard with the gawking onlookers. You laugh. Man must live. Man must live. How casually broken. Tall, lanky man, hands clawed, yams dangling, and the sweet clubman's charm in your grin still. All those women slain by your art. You stretch out your legs, tell your story slow, persistent as the crawl you made towards sunlight. The way you pulled your body upright, the way you made tender the toughness of hard men who would soon wash you, feed you with oily fingers full of mashed ackee and tomatoes, who have held you against the night. Men, tough as teeth, men, hard men. Man must live, man must live. The virus prances through your blood, manages to tickle, make you laugh at a new sunny day, and yours is the posture of survival.
That is the representation of the poem Nickel as part of the much larger project called, what is it called? It's Live, Hope, Love.
Live, Hope, Love.
Yeah, Living and Loving with AIDS, HIV/AIDS in Jamaica. Kwame Dawes, you heard his voice in there. Obviously, he wrote the poetry that led to lyrics as well. It's an amazing project when you think about it.
It's fantastic. Yeah. And that composite, the whole compositional work by Kevin Simmons, who I've worked with many times, It's just beautiful work, beautiful work. And we did a piece, Wisteria, which was set in South Carolina, and just some of the most beautiful settings of music for poet that you could find. And this piece is especially one of those lovely ones.
And let's give the singer credit, too. What's her name?
Billy. It's a guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
really?
Young little tenor. What's Billy's last name? I forget Billy's last name. Yeah, I'll try and remember.
Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought up South Carolina because I was going to, you did spend a fair amount of time there as well, it sounds like.
I lived there for 19 years. We lived in South Carolina for 19 years, and that remained sort of my entry point into the U.S. I'd been to the States before, of course, but this was where we settled to live. And one of the peculiar things about being an immigrant into America is if you're from the Caribbean and you land in places like New York or Miami, there's a Jamaican community, there's a Caribbean community.
All in Queens.
All in Queens, that's right. And so your integration is quite different. You don't really have to become that integrated. You sort of just hang out with the Caribbean people. But in South Carolina, there were some Jamaicans, but there was no real community. And that was a wonderful circumstance because it brought me closer to the African-American community and to be part of that community. And living in Sumter, that became my our family and our community. And so the poems that emerged out of that time, whether it was a collection like Jaco Jacobus or Prophets or Wisteria, were all poems of Midlands, were all poems set in South Carolina or influenced by this wonderful way in which I discover the Caribbean, in Charleston or Africa in the Low Country, and self in this new and complex historical landscape called South Carolina.
You wrote Requiem while you were there, is that
right? I wrote Requiem there as well. Yeah, so and I owe a great debt to that space. Yeah.
So Requiem was based on Middle Passage, White Ships, Black Cargo, with artwork by Tom Phelan. So there were these great images first, and then you turned those into poems.
Yeah, I mean the weird. There was always a story behind a book because that book came about because I had found Tom Phelan's book, which is a wonderful book of art and drawings, in charcoal and in ink. Of the Middle Passage, no text at all. It was this book. And I got this book and I went through this book and I was just so moved by it. And I knew Tom Phelan was living in Colombia at the time. I didn't know him. And so I decided to write him a letter just saying, thank you for this wonderful book. And what happened was, it was this, I think 30 poems came out. The letter began literally. I mean, the first poem in the book says, Dear Tom, right?
Oh, right.
So I was writing a letter.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And soon there were poem after poem after poem. And when I was done, I thought, well, this is embarrassing. I just wanted to thank the guy for the book. And I said, well, let me just send it to him. And I sent it to him. He contacted me. I went over to the studio. We met and we made connections. He had been in Ghana when I was a child. I mean, I didn't know any of this.
Wow.
And we became very good friends. We collaborated on a children's book. But he gave us permission to use his artwork for the cover of the collection, which was published. But also, we did a performance with his art and the poems. And so the poems are really an homage to Tom. Yeah. And again, because of the connection on the Middle Passage and the narratives of the Middle Passage, it became this wonderful triangular engagement with the Atlantic at the middle of it.
I'm reminded again by this work about the centrality of South Carolina to the slave trade.
Yeah.
And then I also remember the fact that you spent that much time in South Carolina. I wonder what you were going through with the church shootings over the summer.
It's powerfully moving and disturbing because I know the church. You know, I attended a church in Colombia, and the moment is not strange. You know, somebody comes in, a stranger, and this is what we would do. They'll come in and you'd be sitting there awkwardly and it's a little awkward and you're saying, okay, at some point we'll have to go outside and talk to him and find out what his issue is and so on and so forth. And then he starts to kill people. But you know the moment. It's a weird sense that you know the moment. And it's so familiar, and it's so immediate, and it's so disturbing. It's I'm writing poems about it. It's that powerful to me, very moving and very disturbing.
We're hearing the music of Bob Marley's Exodus on the way to the break. Kwame Dawes, of course, wrote some other work about, he wrote a whole book about Bob Marley's lyrical genius. And so we'll come back and talk more with Kwame Dawes and enjoy Bob Marley on the way to the break. Words and music of Bob Marley, Buffalo Soldier, as a way of introduction back to Kwame Dawes, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, who's a poet, novelist, singer, Emmy Award winner, and did write a book about Bob Marley's lyrical genius. He'll be appearing tonight at 7:30 at Ashland High School, brought here by Chautauqua Poets and Writers, and he's our guest in the studio. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about the art of Kwame Dawes and the things that he writes about. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the church shooting in South Carolina. You spent 19 years in South Carolina. You're writing poetry about it, you say now.
Yeah.
Not at all surprising, given what happened there. I'm curious to know about just outside of the poetry, your response to things like the lowering of the Confederate flag. I mean, is this as big a deal as some people would make of it?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal. I think because I was there when we couldn't get the flag down, and the arguments that came around it. I think it introduces a really peculiar kind of discourse that those who were resistant to taking the flag down have to construct to explain why they agreed now to take the flag down. Because if the narrative surrounds the idea that this atrocity took place and that has now convinced them that this is why the flag should come down, then at the very least, the period before that is a period of abject ignorance or negligence that characterized their resistance to it. So I think it's a moment that was important that the state, I thought, reached the point where they said, if this has created the kind of offense that is manifest in this action, then there's no way we can seriously defend it being up. The irony is, of course, that it has always represented this kind of action. This is a dramatic moment where we've seen it manifest in a most atrocious way. But there are too many narratives exactly that, as you know, from the 60s right up until now, that demonstrate what it does represent. And so to me, it's an important moment, and I think it makes its own kind of sense that this happened. I think it's a good thing, but it doesn't exonerate anybody from the responsibility of why there was the resistance to seeing the very human fact of community that says if a large portion of your community says this is offensive to us, in any kind of Christian discourse, your response has to be that if it so offends you, then even if I see nothing wrong with it, out of my love and respect for you, I will remove it because it doesn't hurt me to do that. And the failure to do that over time in a state where the language of sort of Christian accommodation and love is endemic, it shows me a kind of horror, to be honest with you, and a kind of obscene situation. So it's good that it happens, but of course what it means that it happens is not all roses. It's actually cause for us to reflect on how we get to that point.
When you cast it in terms of the narrative that came with the Confederate flag, particularly the heritage, not hate, was the phrase that got used the most. I mean, yeah. You're talking about the very same thing we talked about earlier, the fleeting, delusionary kind of control of your story. But then when you're done telling that story, other people can go, no, that's not it.
That's precisely it. And it, in truth, it is the greatest act of civility to be able to then say, this is how we've told our story. There is another story that's being told. And this is why I talked about the idea of story and who tells the story. Because who tells the story changes the story in many ways. But when you do as a community recognize these two different stories, then the question is, who is hurting? And who do we cherish? Who do we protect in the hurt? And what those who resisted the removal of the flag for decades, they were being... They resisted the idea that they're going to be generous, to be civil, and to be kind. They were being mean and vicious and hard-nosed. There's no other way to see it. Even if they felt that it was a misread of what people are saying, they knew it was hurting. They knew that their families, who the flag was flying while their family were being lynched, they knew that. So there is an obscenity to that resistance. And I know people think it's kind of churlish to then say, well, they did change it eventually. I said, well, yeah, but let's remember how we got here, because that's also part of the narrative, and it's very important to talk about it.
You seem to understand the cultures in which you spend any time quite easily. I mean, are you able to drop back into Jamaica as if you'd never, I mean, four or five times a year, it sounds like you're always there. I don't know if you get the same way with Ghana.
Yeah, it is. That is a gift of being an artist, not a gift of something I was born with. Who knows what I was born with? I don't know. But what I do know is, I've practiced this. You know, empathy, imagination is something you practice. It's not something that you just have. You have to practice it. You know, I tell the story of somebody saying to me, you know, Kwame, you know, I don't know, man. I don't know what it's like for you to be like a black guy, you know, because I can't imagine how hard that is and so on. And my answer to you is like, try. You know, you don't get off. And if you say you're a writer, you really don't get off. Use your imagination. That's the point. So can I write about a woman giving birth? I better work on it. Now, the challenge would be that I have a higher bar of achievement to make. Somebody can say to me, that's not how it went, and I have to work harder at it. But that's still what I do. I imagine, I listen, I pay attention, I practice that, because I really believe that capacity is something that we can learn. I mean, that's what we mean when we say people should be civil and care about each other. Think about, we tell our kids, how do you think Jamie felt when you slapped him in the head? How would you feel about that? That's what we tell them. That's all imagination. Imagine it and then act on it. So with practice, I think it can happen. I think the sad thing is when we take away the opportunities for imagination, art, music, and all of these things, we are in fact creating monstrosities in people who have not exercised that muscle in their body, in their souls, and therefore they are able to live in ways that are hateful and wrong, simply because they say we just never understood it was that bad.
So what do you make then of the trends in education that say, you know, we more science, more math, more technology, and then, you know, if we have time for the arts, we'll do that?
I think it's sad. I think it's a mistake. And I think it's a mistake because, for instance, in science, I mean, anybody looking at the history of science will recognize that there is a great deal of art and there's a great deal of passion and all of the things that we talk about related to the arts in the sciences. But I think that inclination is a mistake. It's the same mistake that surrounds, does it make money? Like if I go to a school and they say, well, how much money do you make as a poet? Implying that if I say nothing, they'll go, well, you're a waste of time. Why should we bother with you? And I think that's what a nation does to itself. A nation can say, this is valuable. And it doesn't have to put a money on it, but it should show why it's valuable to a culture and to a society. poetry is older than anybody talking about science this and science that. We cry, we weep, we laugh, we make love, we celebrate it with language. That's as old as human life. And we when somebody is suffering, they want a poet to come and bring healing. They don't want a bridge built. They want a poet to come and bring healing. And that's important. When somebody wants to get across a river, they don't want a poet. They want a bridge builder. And that's okay, too. The poet can write about the bridge building and leave it at that.
Well, I was just thinking about suffering in the context of 9/11. And remember the members of Congress getting together and singing?
And singing.
Before we built anything.
That's right.
They got together and sang God Bless America.
And how many times do we hear Auden's poem being read again and again?
About the
that's
stop
right.
all the clocks?
That's right.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Let's hear another piece from the Live, Hope, Love series. Let's go to Dawes Storm from Kwame Dawes.
Kingston settles on your skin, the grid of wood, fire, and exhaust on your body. You know, see, the pleasure of untrammeled love.
The thing is, they know it, and the others are busy nursing the dying. I will live to see the wasting of my flesh. My last breath will be in a calm season. They will know my sins, every betrayal, those I killed, those whose voices whisper to me until tears come, until I pray to slip away like night, a frail man limping towards morning light.
Kingston settles on your skin, the grid of wood, fire, and exhaust on your body. You know, sin, the pleasure of untrammeled lust.
Is called Storm, a poem written by Kwame Dawes, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and then converted into music for part of Live, Hope, Love, Living and Loving with HIV AIDS in Jamaica. It's an amazing website. Did you know websites were eligible for Emmy Awards when this won?
No. Absolutely had no idea. I mean, probably the, it was a new award. It was a new award in innovative use of media. And so it was a new award when that happened. And I think the Pulitzer Center may have known about it. The Pulitzer Center represents a new kind of response to the gradual reduction of foreign bureaus around the world. And the Pulitzer Center became this independent organization that sends freelance reporters around the world. And I think their arrival in the late 2000s changed the entire game for media, and I think it changed it even for awards like that. So it was a new prize, and you know, it was, you know, the BBC was in it, the, you know, ABC. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of big names that we were up against, so it was kind of cute. Yeah. It's kind of cute to win.
You know, we've just sort of I've used the Bob Marley music, but we haven't talked about your writing about Bob Marley, about reggae in general, and the centrality of it to the Jamaican experience.
Yeah, you know, recently some interesting thing developed. Marlon James, the novelist who just won the Man Booker Award, which is a big deal, was the first Jamaican to win it, and so on. And his novel is called Brief History of Seven Killings, and the press makes a big deal of the fact that at the center of the novel is the assassination attempt of Bob Marley, called The Singer in the work. And he doesn't figure that much in the work, but in a sense, by doing that, Marlon is pointing to making clear that this whole construction that is happening here is around this idea of reggae. And Marlon himself doesn't sort of see himself as a big reggae guy, but he cannot help but be talking about what I've described as an aesthetic, that is an aesthetic that comes out of reggae music, which is a very complex aesthetic that brings in larger cosmologies and ideas of identity and place and that kind of thing, to shape a literature, to shape a movement, and also to shape this the everyday life of people, in the sense that if I, you know, when I went to China and I had a Bob Marley t-shirt, people knew me as they said, oh, Bob Marley, and I'm in China, for God's sake. So it's my passport into the world. Yeah.
Wow. You'll hear a lot from Kwame Dawes if you happen to catch him tonight at Ashland High School, Monday at 7:30, brought here by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. We'll close out with Satisfy My Soul, and I want to thank you very much, Kwame, for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
This has been a pleasure. It just went so quickly. Thank you so much for having me.
An hour goes by fast.
It sure does.
All right, with good company. Emily Curitan is the producer of the Jefferson Exchange, and Megan Mercier is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.